Welcome to the Versus History Podcast with your hosts, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, Connell Smith and Elliot Watson.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this episode of the Versus History Podcast. It's me, your host, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, at History Chappie on social media. Today, we have the second of our Wolfson History Prize 2021 specials. We are joined by historian Judith Herring, who's the author of the epic book, Ravenna, the Capital of Empire, the Crucible of Europe. Welcome to Versus History, Judith. We're delighted to have you with us.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Thank you so much. Well, we're humbled and honoured. So let's get the proverbial ball rolling. Please tell us a little bit about you, if you will, and your background as a historian.
I suppose I started out thinking medieval history was so much more relevant than modern, contemporary, or even Reformation history, that I got to be committed to the medieval, the Middle Ages. And I did find that at Cambridge, when I was studying medieval history, there was a very heavy concentration on England, France, Germany. There wasn't very much about Italy, and there was almost nothing about the East Mediterranean until you get to the period of the Crusades, when there are crusaders from the West who come to win back the holy places from the Muslims, to put down Islam and reassert Christian control in Jerusalem and all those other important cities in the East. And of course, on the way, they passed through Constantinople, where they met the emperor of the Byzantine Empire. And that is the point at which this great empire becomes relevant to people who study the Western Middle Ages. And I realized that there was a lot more going on before the Crusades that had to be explained. What was this empire? Who was this emperor? How was it that he had all this gold? And what about this amazing capital city, Constantinople, which was actually the largest in the known world outside of China at the time? For many, many centuries, it was the largest. And it was a source of enormous inspiration to people who were interested in the ancient world, because they got to the texts of ancient Greece and even ancient Rome through copies that were made in Constantinople. And that's why they are, the Byzantines are so tremendously important to the culture of the rest of the world. However, I was really interested in the fact that this empire didn't make much of an impression in the syllabus at Cambridge University. And I decided that it would be important to make the empire more relevant and better known to the rest of the world. And I got hooked on it because I was taught by a very great coin expert, Philip Grierson. And he used to actually bring coins into the lecture room and pass them around and say, look, here's a good bit of gold. Do you know that the Byzantine Empire minted a gold currency that was stable, that maintained its value for 700 years? Well, that's quite something. So again, I got interested in its economic prowess and how it got to be so important. And this is the result, that was the result of learning about these coins. And I went on to learn more about Byzantium and did my doctorate in that field, and I've been working on it ever since. Still very much hooked on the Byzantines.
Well, you've sold us, Judith. Thank you very much indeed. Okay, something of a more playful question, and just so we can get to know the Judith behind the historian, behind the doctorate. So here's a scenario for you. You're stranded on a desert island by yourself. You can pick which desert island that is. You can take an unlimited supply of one culinary delight and also one drink aside from water and one book. So which food, which drink and which book do you take to the tropical island of your choice? Over to you.
Well, I'm sure it's going to be very hot, but I do need coffee in the morning.
Absolutely.
I will have a cup of coffee, please. That's my drink. And because I'm very fond of breakfast, I think I better have hot buttered toast in an unlimited supply, good bread, sourdough, granary bread, and homemade marmalade jam, Marmite, all these good things you put on your hot buttered toast. So that's my culinary delight. And I think for a book, I will take a complete opera guide, because the really good opera guides tell you about the scenarios of the operas, the stories, and then they print you some of the major arias, and you can actually read the music and you can learn the words and sing along. So since I'm very fond of opera, I think I'll take that as my distraction.
Fantastic. It's an eternal breakfast on your tropical island. Thank you very much indeed. Slightly more serious now then. So what is your fantastic book, Ravenna, all about? If you had to summarise it for someone maybe passing through Waterstones on their way to work, either at Waterloo Station, Clapham Junction or Penn in New York, what's it about?
It's about a small city in the northwest of Italy. Sorry, northeast. I must get my compass points right. It's on the eastern coast of Italy, at the mouth of the Po River, which has an enormous delta that lots and lots of streams that go down to the Adriatic Sea. And in the period before there was Venice, this is very critical. Venice really didn't come into existence until about the year 800. Ravenna was the great port of the eastern coast of Italy and had been selected as the harbour for the East Mediterranean Navy, the Roman Navy that patrolled the East Mediterranean. So it was a very, very important centre in naval terms and in communication with the entire Mediterranean world. And then, although it was still quite a small city, it became a very important city when the Emperor Honorius, in the year 402, early 5th century, this is the late Roman period, realized that he couldn't defend his capital city in Milan because he didn't have the manpower to man the walls. And it was suggested that he should go to Ravenna, which was very secure, smaller, compact, and had all the necessary facilities to make it a capital city. It just had to be enhanced. And when the Emperor Honorius moved to Ravenna, he made it the capital of the Roman Empire in the West. And it immediately became a very much more important city, with enormous buildings for the government, which had to follow the emperor, the imperial court, all the hangers-on who wanted to get jobs in the empire, in the administration, military people, civilians who were good at writing documents, people who kept the records, and then those people who organized the court hierarchy and all the ceremonies and would accompany the emperor on his military expeditions. He had a guard of honor, he had all his soldiers. Lots and lots of people all ended up in Ravenna with enormous new buildings built for them. And in addition to becoming an imperial capital and having this huge expansion, it also realized its new status as the most important city in the Roman Empire in the West, although that empire was in serious decline. And that status was maintained by later rulers who went to live in Ravenna, sometimes because they didn't fancy living in Rome. And Rome, of course, was still a very important center, but it was more or less under the control of the Bishop of Rome, became the Pope, and it was therefore a religious center, more than an administrative or a military center. And Ravenna maintained its importance as the military, administrative, governmental center, because many kings who inherited the rule, what had been the Roman Empire in the West, preferred to live there. So the first was Odoacer, and the second was the Gothic king Theodoric, who was a great builder, and his churches and his tomb, his great mausoleum, remain to this day, so they can be admired. And the extraordinary thing about this city is that it has in its churches and palaces and other monuments the greatest collection of early Christian mosaics in the most glorious colours, mainly on golden backgrounds, which shine in the candlelight, which must have illuminated those monuments. And they are absolutely fantastic. There's the greatest concentration there in the Western world, and they are all quite close together. So when you go to visit this city, Ravenna, you can actually walk around and visit nearly all of them in a day or two. It's a wonderful, wonderful experience. And that's why Ravenna is such a fascinating city to write about. And I discovered in doing so that its history was also very, very interesting. And that's what the book's about.
Well, you've certainly sold me. Thank you very, very much indeed, Judith. Okay, next question then. Always interests our budding historians. How did you go about researching your book, Ravenna? And why do you think this history is so necessary and so pertinent right now?
I describe in the introduction to the book how I was, I visited as a child, and then I was a teenager, a rather grumpy teenager, I expect. And then I was taken back with the family to revisit about 15 years ago. And so I'd already written quite a lot of books about Byzantium, and I looked at Ravenna again, and I thought, it's very strange that there's really nothing to explain why there's a wonderful mosaic of the Emperor Justinian and his wife, the Empress Theodora, in the really holy part of one of these churches up by the altar. Very, very unusual to find these secular rulers, and some of them, you know, Theodora supposed to be such a monstrous, wicked woman, and the Emperor Justinian, you know, a megalomaniac of some sort. Why are their portraits still there? Who put them up? What are they doing there? We know they never went there. They barely left Constantinople, where he was the emperor and she was the empress. So because of this failure of guidebooks to explain why they were there, I thought, well, I should write a little guidebook to Ravenna that would say, this is why they're there and I can explain this. And I thought, well, that would be quite easy. It won't take me very long. Not at all. This was a great adventure of 9 years.
Of course.
It led me to the most extraordinary history. And I was so fascinated. I couldn't stop discovering new things about Ravenna. And as I realized what an important role it had played in the growth of a concept of Europe, that's when I thought, now this is really, really important today, because the European Union is struggling. Everybody knows that the Euro wasn't a great success or hasn't been a terrific success. The UK has decided to leave. I mean, I think that was a really stupid decision, but that's I was not voting for Brexit. But there is a query over the future of the European Union. And I feel very strongly that Europe is a very important power today in the world between the great power bases of America and China. And there's Russia hovering around there. And then there are all these awful things going on in the Middle East and Turkey. And in this global situation, the European Union has a serious role to play. And I think it's very interesting to look at the roots of that role of cooperation, collaboration, finding ways around military problems, not resorting to violence, tolerating bits of differences of religion in particular. That's, I think, something that Europe stands for. And if we can see that these were in nuce, they were actually being developed in Ravenna, in the period between the 5th and the 8th centuries AD. Isn't that interesting? And should we look back to that and salute the achievements of this city, which really laid down a path for European development?
Thank you, Judith. Okay, the next question, it's a causation question. Why were scholars, lawyers, doctors, craftsmen, cosmologists, and religious luminaries drawn to Ravenna, where they created a cultural and political capital that dominated northern Italy and the Adriatic? What do you think were the key causal factors, and which do you consider to be the most significant?
The reason all these different people were drawn to Ravenna was that it was a very important cultural centre where there were lots of rich patrons who were interested in employing scholars, craftsmen, doctors, all these lawyers, all these other people that you mentioned. They found jobs there, and they found positions both in the administration of the government or in the church or in the region where they could buy land or acquire land and farm and become important landowners. And they were attracted by the role that Ravenna was playing in dominating this area. So they went primarily because people wanted their skills. The court particularly needed these scribes and lawyers and administrators and people who were competent with not just pen and ink, because, you know, they were writing with quill pens in ink made of charcoal on parchment or even on papyrus, which is a very important writing material in this period. It's made from reeds and it's very, very flimsy, so it doesn't survive very well through all the centuries since the 7th and 8th. But scribes were writing on papyrus and they were keeping records in triplicate in Ravenna. And some of these papyri have survived and they give us an incredible amount of information about the people who were attracted to work or live or visit Ravenna. Many of these individuals are documented in people who stand as witnesses to legal documents. Mainly these are documents about the sale of land or about gifts to the church or about taxes that are owed. The finance ministers want to make sure that the landowners or the peasants pay their taxes. And the people who witness these documents saying, yes, this is a legal binding document and I agree that it's true and it's a proper record, they give their names, they give their professions, and we find out that, you know, they are from Antioch in the East Mediterranean, that they call themselves Syrian merchants, that they deal in the manufacture and the export of silks or spices or soap, all these very important things which are coming into Ravenna as luxury goods, or they are simply local people who live in Ravenna and know the individuals who are involved in the transaction and stand as witnesses for them to guarantee that the legality of the document. And they give their names and they say how they're related. So we have an enormous amount of information about individuals who lived in the city or who were visiting and wished to make legal, draw up legal documents. So some of them, these visitors, made their wills. That's very interesting because they say, I have all this property and I'm going to give it to the Church of Ravenna. And then they list the property that they have bought while they were in Ravenna. And we have descriptions of their houses and gardens and their orchards and the sorts of fruit and nuts that they got from their orchards and the produce that they grew on their land. All these things are listed. And we can see that the Church of Ravenna, when it was given these properties, became very, very wealthy. And it drew on all the goods. It would say, now we are due to have so many chickens, so many dozen eggs, so many litres of milk, and please don't forget the honey. All these items are listed. And you can get a sense that the city is rich and it's drawing on all this wealth that has come in from people who've been attracted to work in Ravenna. And that seems to me to be a proof that it was a very, very lively place, full of interesting people, a great mixture of people. Some of these witnesses sign their names in Greek because they come from the East Mediterranean and they are Greek speaking, or they know Greek and they want to sign in Greek because this is perhaps it's just a status symbol. And then there are still Gothic inhabitants who use Gothic. They sign their, these, they make their signatures in Gothic. And of course, Gothic is a language that we don't understand today. We can't even read the alphabet unless we've done a lot of work, because it's basically a Slavic language, a Germanic language that has been put into given an alphabet and now is written down. But of course, we don't. It no longer exists. It's been transferred into Old High German and these other medieval Germanic languages. Nonetheless, we get this sense of an enormous variety of people coming together in Ravenna because it's such an important centre.
Thank you very much, Judith. Okay, the next question picks up on some of the themes you were talking about Ravenna being this melting pot of different cultures. So how did Ravenna become the pivot or the kissing point between East and West, the meeting point of so many different disparate cultures coming together almost as one in Ravenna? How so?
Yes, it is very strange. And I think the main impetus for this very key role that it plays between the East, Constantinople, and the East Mediterranean, and the West, and that includes Transalpine Europe, Northern Europe, where the Franks and the Burgundians and the other Gothic tribes are settled, in Spain and places. And it becomes this centre because in the late 5th century, King Theodoric, who was the leader of the Goths, Western Goths, negotiated with the Emperor Zeno in Constantinople and made a sort of an arrangement, a treaty, some sort of negotiation, which he interpreted to mean that he should lead his people, take them out of the Eastern world and bring them across the Balkans, across the very, very long march across the Hungarian plain and into northern Italy, so that he could reconquer Ravenna and rule it in the name of the Emperor of Constantinople. But actually, he considered himself very independent. And in bringing this quite considerable number of Goths, I mean, we don't know how many, but perhaps 80,000, and women and children and cattle and all their belongings in wagons that made this long, long journey, bringing them to settle in Ravenna brought a Germanic element, a Gothic presence into the Roman world. And the King Theodoric insisted on a synthesis of these two features, the Gothic and the Roman. And he created a law book which established that the Goths could be judged by their Gothic judges and the Romans by their Roman judges, but the law had to be applied in the way that he'd written it down. And this was clearly a very important bringing together of traditions which had been entirely separate and remained quite antagonistic in many parts of the late Roman West, where the so-called barbarians, these Germanic tribes, were crossing the frontiers, occupying the territory, burning the cities in a fashion that was very hostile. And they brought with them their own legal traditions, which weren't written down, but which were very, very firmly observed. And these were more of the eye for an eye and an arm for an arm and a punishment of crimes in a fairly violent fashion, which was always in some opposition to the Roman traditions of law. And of course, gradually they did manage to come to some sort of agreement, and it worked out in the end. But in Ravenna, we see a very purposeful synthesis of the Germanic and the Roman. And in addition, Theodoric brought his own understanding of imperial traditions. And he had been a hostage, a child hostage, in the imperial court in Constantinople for a decade. And in that critical period, when he was between about 8 and 18, I mean, just imagine growing up in the imperial court as a Gothic hostage. If his father broke the treaty that had been made, he would have been for the chop. So Theodoric knew, and his father knew, that it was very important that they stick to the terms of that had been negotiated in the peace treaty that had been written between the Goths and the Romans. So there he was in the imperial court in Constantinople, learning Greek, learning Latin, probably participating in all the necessary things that a young adult in the Roman world has to know. Handling of weapons, horsemanship, shooting, fighting, hunting, and then attending the emperor at court. Because as a hostage, he had to be on show with all the other hostages, and we know there were quite a lot, including one from Georgia in the Caucasus, and even some female hostages. And they were all displayed, wearing fine clothes at major celebrations like the great feasts. We hear about these feasts because we know about how they were organized and how the tables were set out, and the people who sat next to the emperor were at the top table, and the people who sat lower down were very aggrieved because they weren't closer. And there were lower tables, but there the hostages had to, they either had to wait the tables as pages, learning to be a page, serving drinks and bringing the dishes to the table, or they participated in the feasts and were on display. And when the emperor wanted to call for entertainment, he could call on the organ players and the dancers and the entertainers, or he could say, "And here are my hostages." And they would have to file out and make their bows and explain who they were and so on. So there was a very important, Theodoric had a very important exposure to the imperial method of governing. And it's absolutely clear that he learned a lot about how to administer an empire, how to get in the taxes, how to arrange diplomatic arrangements, negotiations, send out embassies, and military matters as well. And he brought all that to Ravenna, and it became enshrined in the city's government. And because he ruled for a very long time, he was able to entrench these traditions in Ravenna, to which other cities in the West had not been exposed. And this really meant that there was always a very strong presence of the emperor in Constantinople in the city. And this was reinforced in the year 540, when Justinian sent his emperor, his general Belisarius, to reconquer Italy. And he finally made it to Ravenna and removed the Gothic king and courtiers and established direct rule from Constantinople in Ravenna. And it extended over all of Italy and Sicily and a great deal of southern France and Spain. And this is the territory called the Exarchate of Ravenna. And he renewed contacts with the East Mediterranean, and Ravenna therefore benefited more than other cities from being at the center of this imperial administration. The governors were sent from Constantinople to head the Exarchate. They were called Exarchs, and they lived in Ravenna, and they organized the military and civilian administration in conjunction with the city bishop, who was a very important figure, the leading religious figure. And they set up a system of government that was more effective, I would argue, than most of the kingdoms of the post-Roman West. Now, of course, there was a lot of antagonism to this imperial administration, and in Rome particularly, over theological matters, the bishops were subjected to imperial pressure, and Popes Virgilius and Martin were indeed taken from the city and imprisoned in Constantinople and then sent into exile. So there was this presence of the emperor in Italy was not welcomed by all, but nonetheless, in Ravenna and in the territories that were governed by the exarch, there was a certain degree of respect and admiration and benefit, for example, in the use of the coinage, the imperial coinage, and in the imposition of law, and the notion of being connected to the cultural center of the East and being aware of Greek culture as it was developing in the 7th and 8th centuries.
Thank you, Judith. Okay, the next question. To what extent or how far does your book reaffirm or perhaps even challenge the existing historical canon on Ravenna or the historiography on this topic? Over to you.
Well, this book aims to correct the general neglect of Ravenna after its heyday when these early Christian monuments were built from the early 5th to the early 6th century. That's when the great mosaics were put up. And after that period, most historians aren't interested in anything else about Ravenna. And so they really miss the whole period of the Exarchate, which, as I've argued, really was a very glorious period for Ravenna and for Italy, those parts of Italy that were governed from Ravenna. There was another part of Italy in the northwest that was governed by the Lombards, and the imperial forces and the Lombard forces were constantly at each other's throats. So there was more or less continual, not warfare, but hostility. But nonetheless, the period, the government of that was organized in Ravenna was very effective, and it did for a long time protect Italy from the Lombards. Eventually that failed, and that's why the Exarchate came to an end. But I think the whole period after 540, the two centuries from 540 to 751, which is the date when Ravenna fell to the Lombards, finally passed under their control, those two centuries are very important in the history of Italy and Ravenna. And it's important to remember that even though the buildings may not have been so beautiful, there were certainly not so many wonderful mosaics, but there was this very lively cultural life. And we see it in the form of the medical school and in the witness of this anonymous scribe who wrote a cosmography, a history of the world, how it came about in about the year 700. And this cosmographer is one of the many extraordinary things that I discovered in writing about Ravenna. And of course, it shows that this was a very lively city with many books, many documents and sources about geography and about world history that this anonymous author could use. So I wanted to draw attention to these achievements, which seem to me to be part of the very lively cultural life of the city of Ravenna that have been very much ignored.
Thank you, Judith. The final question from us, it's quite a wordy one. I'm sure you'll make sense of it. The book argues that in the 5th to the 8th century should not be perceived as a time of decline from antiquity, but rather, thanks to Byzantium, as one of great creativity, the period of early Christendom, that these were, in essence, the formative centuries of Europe. How so?
Well, the inventiveness of this period of adjustment to the failure of the late Roman Empire and the rise of many smaller national states in the West has long been realized. But in religious terms, there seems to have been a failure to recognize the very, very important theological adjustments that occurred in this period. So between the 5th and the 8th centuries, we witnessed the emergence of the Islamic world of the Muslims, the emergence of an Eastern Orthodox world, which persists today in Greece and Russia, and the existence of a Latin Catholic Church in the West. And Islam is a major factor in planting the seeds of what became a European identity, because of course the Christian leaders realized that they were deeply threatened by the Muslim revelation. It's fascinating to me to realize that these three great monotheistic religions believed in the same one God. This was the God of the Muslims, Allah, and the God of the Christians. And they also believed that the heavenly that after death, there was a heaven, and that they could indeed get a place in heaven if they behaved correctly. And that's a very, very important change in the mentality of the world from the Roman period, when all the pagan gods lived on the Mount Olympus, but there was absolutely no question about humans getting up to Mount Olympus when they died. Indeed, the bodies of the Roman emperors were burned, and their souls were spirited up But there was no physical rebirth in heaven. So there was a very, very important religious shift that took place in this period of the what I call early Christendom. Because if we think of it just as decline from antiquity, we're always looking backwards and saying, why was this different from the pagan Roman period or the ancient Greek period? And I think the people who lived in the 5th to 8th centuries were looking forward. They were looking to a world in which their religion would convert everybody else, and everybody would be illuminated, would be informed, and would know the truth. And they would then believe it, and they would worship the same God, but in the right way. And it's quite clear that the leaders of the Muslim states wanted Islam to be the world dominant religion, while the people who were Christian felt exactly the same. And they constantly wished to convert all the others to the true faith, to their revelation of the true faith. And this is why the Crusades were so critical, because for the first time, major forces were sent from the West to conquer the centers that had become Muslim centers in the East Mediterranean. So I think there's a very novel force that comes into being in the period of early Christendom, when Christian faith becomes utterly dominant in the northern part of the Mediterranean and has to confront the southern Mediterranean faith of Islam and realize that there is yet another monotheistic revelation, in addition, of course, to the ancient Jewish revelation, which is the Old Testament, which still persisted, of course, because there were Jewish communities all over the Mediterranean world. So these three great monotheistic faiths were in rivalry, and their rivalry comes to a point, if you like, comes to a high point in this period between the 5th and the 8th centuries, when they're all looking to a religious domination. So it's a very novel force, and it's in this that's why this period is so important, and we ought to be thinking about it as formative, because it gave us the notion of Christian Europe, which separated itself from the idea of the Christian East, where the Orthodox Church maintained its own definitions of Christian faith, worshipped in Greek or in Russian or in Bulgarian, these other languages that had been, and Armenian and Georgian and all the other languages into which the early Christian documents had been translated. And they all felt the same threat from the Muslim revelations that dominated the Islamic world. And we must remember that it's in this period that the Islamic world, blocked by Constantinople and the Pyrenees from spreading into the West, into Western Europe, turned east, and there were missionaries and converts to Islam as far east as the East Indies. So there's a very, very massive spread of Islam towards the east. And it's accompanied also by Christian missions, which get to China in exactly the same time. So there's a very, very important religious predominance that takes place in this world. And I think we should not think of it as late antiquity in decline, but as a period of early Christendom, early Islam. And these are the new denominations that we should use for this period.
Well, thank you so very much, Judith, for sharing that array, that tour de force of knowledge with us about Ravenna. We're so grateful. So on behalf of myself and my co-editors and the audience of the Versus History podcast, we cannot thank you enough, and congratulations on being nominated for the Wolfson History Prize of 2021 for your book, Ravenna, Capital of Empire and Crucible of Europe. Blown away. So much to mull over and digest there. Just the final thing, Judith, our audience is spread around the world. Who publishes the book in various regions? So if they're in, say, Europe or the Americas, where can they get this book from?
So it's published by Alan Lane, Penguin Books, Random House in Europe and England, And the American edition is published by Princeton University Press and is available in the Americas. But the English language world is maintained by Penguin Books.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Versus History Podcast. Visit us at www.versushistory.com and follow us at Versus History on Twitter and Instagram. You can download all episodes from iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or from wherever you get your podcasts.